Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz migurei aviv be'eretz Kenaan eile toledot Yaakov. Yosef ben 17 shana haya roeh esechav batzon vehunar et b'nei vilhav et b'nei zilpah nishay aviv vayavei Yosef et dibatam ra'al avihem v'Yisrael ahav et Yosef mikol banav kiven zikunim hu lo v'asalo ketonet pasim. Yaakov settled in the land of his father's sojourning in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Yaakov. Yosef, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Yosef would bring evil reports about them to their father. Now Yisrael, another name for Yaakov, loved Yosef more than all his sons, since he was a child of his old age, and he made him a fine woolen tunic. That fine woolen tunic, known as ketonet pasim, is the technicolor dream coat, or the multicolored coat, or the striped coat, and we'll talk a lot about this as the show goes on.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Ah, you're here. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayeshev. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 18th day of Kislev, 5774, corresponding to November 21st. November 21st happens to be the secular birthday of two grandsons, Elad and his younger brother Roi, who turn 4 and 2 respectively today. So happy birthday, little guys, and be seeing you, but probably not till tomorrow. But I got some nice things for you, and we'll have a good time. And that's the story. Now, Vayeshev is... oh. Let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed first, Psalm 130, and then we'll get down to Parshat HaShavua and Chanukah, as this is the pre-Chanukah show, since next Thursday's show will be on Chanukah, and I hope we'll be able to do it. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmorya, Adonai mia amod, ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetzunim bat tzara v'ashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'meafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. As I've said many times in the past, it's very hard not to think of Jonathan Pollard when we say this prayer of Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, especially now when he is entering his 29th year in prison for spying in the United States for the benefit of Israel. Well, a lot of things could be said. I was contacted by Jonathan and Esther and asked to put in a Jerusalem Post editorial of a number of weeks ago into Torah Tidbits, and it's in the Hanukkah pullout section. And among many things, it mentions the following. A gross disproportionate sentence, a broken plea agreement, the use of secret evidence, a false charge of treason, ineffective assistance of counsel, ex parte communication between the prosecutors and judge, a lack of due process, and a sentencing procedure infected by false allegations and lies. You read this, you read any of the material about Pollard, and it's really, really tries one's credibility to understand what he's still doing in prison. It is clear that nobody knows how to get out of this absurd situation, and he's the one that is suffering from it. Mentions here in that editorial that even the U.S. government's own damage assessments, now declassified, put the lie to allegations of damage against Pollard. Even Caspar Weinberger, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, who drove Pollard's life sentence, recanted before he died, admitting that the case against Pollard was very exaggerated. I read another piece in the Post a couple of days ago about somebody here in Israel who admitted that he furnished the United States with damaging evidence against Pollard in order to try to get out of the situation, and was assured that he would serve no more than 10 years. And that was violated. It's just something that only God's mercy can get Pollard out. It's not going to be the admissions of the United States government, and it won't even be the actions of the Israeli government. So, Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, that is a sincere prayer, not just for Jonathan Pollard, but especially for Jonathan Pollard. Okay, on to Vayeshev, but with a perspective of the upcoming Chanukah. First of all, the majority of the time, Parshat Miketz, next week's Sedra, is read on Chanukah, as it is this year. And Vayeshev is usually before Chanukah. Vayeshev is Shabbat Chanukah in two situations. A, when Chanukah begins on a Friday, Thursday night being the first candle, then that Shabbat we read Vayeshev, and the following Shabbat is the day after Chanukah, we read Miketz. It's the only situation in which Miketz is not read on Chanukah, and therefore it's the only situation in which we read the regular Haftorah of Miketz, which is the well-known story of Shlomo and the babies, and that happens roughly 10% of the time. In other words, 90% of the time, Miketz is Shabbos Chanukah, and in the other 10%, Vayeshev is. Then there's another situation where Chanukah runs from Shabbat to Shabbat, first candle and last candle being Friday. And therefore, in those years, you've got the first day is a Shabbat Vayeshev, and the last day is a Shabbat Miketz. So, for sure, Vayeshev and Miketz are the Sedras of Chanukah, and Vayeshev is really the one that takes the role of build-up to Chanukah. It brings us into Chanukah, either by being read right before or in those 17-point-something% of the time, early in Chanukah. So it's very important to take a look. Now, there is no official tie between a sedra and the calendar dates that occur when we're reading that sedra. But we know that that's not really so, because every time we take a peek in the sedra at a holiday time, we have something to talk about relative to the holiday. And here we have a very serious thing. But let's look at it first as a Parshat HaShavua thing, and then we will get into it as the lead into Hanukkah. Now, we start with the piece that I read at the beginning, and I read more verses than I usually do because it's important there to establish the foundation of the hatred between the brothers and Yosef. And the two of the psukim that I read tell it to you. Number one, that Yosef brought bad reports about his brothers to their father, and that Yaakov, nonetheless, loved Yosef more than his other sons, and this apparently was obvious to them. And the multicolored cloak, garment, makes it an obvious kind of thing. Now, the Torah continues. The brothers saw that it was Yosef that their father loved over all of the brothers. Next word, very important word, Vayisne'u oto, and they hated him. The next verse says that Yosef had a dream and he told his brothers, Vayosifu od sino oto. They further hated him because of the dream that he told about. Vayomer alehim, listen to my dream. So one of the sheaves bowing down to his sheav. And then it says, Vayosifu od sino oto al chalomotov va'al devarav. They hated him yet further, deeper, because of his dreams and because of what he said to them about his dreams. Three times in the opening verses of Vayeshev, it uses the H word. The brothers hated Yosef. Now, this sort of rings a bell with that word, not from the text in last week's sedra, but in the medrash that Rashi brings down in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who said, Halacha hi biyadua she'esav sone, there it is, Liakov. It is a well-known fact of Jewish life that Esav hates Yaakov. Here we've got a sadder use of the term hate, because Esav and Yaakov, as I mentioned last week, even though they were twins and they shared the same womb, they became representatives of the Jewish people and our enemies. So when you say that an enemy of the Jewish people hates the Jewish people, that's bad enough. When you're talking about the brothers, and you say that the brothers hated one of their brothers, and they further hated one of their brothers, and they further still hated one of their brothers, then it's very, very, very sad. Now that pushes us to take a look at Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a celebration of the victory of the Jewish people over one of their enemies. In this particular case, the Yevanim, the Hellenists. But, generalize it, it represents a victory over the Yevanim, over our enemy, over the Esavs of the world. Not, again, genealogically identifying Esav with Greece, but conceptually. And the miracles, which we'll talk about also. But what's not built in an obvious way to the celebration of Chanukah is an echo, a strong echo, of the clash between the brothers. Now, let me make something clear. Yosef's brothers and Yosef had their issues, had their own personalities, but I am generalizing as whatever the reason, whatever the cause, whatever the personalities are, there should not be hatred between brothers. That's a bad thing. When the Midrash tells us, God said to the people of Israel, "You sold your brother into slavery. I swear that every year you will recite, 'We were slaves to Paro in Egypt.'" That's what comes from the jealousy, which became hatred, which manifests itself in actions that the brothers took, and the results were disastrous. That, again, generalizing, sets the stage for our examination of any clashes that split apart the Jewish people. They don't have to be exactly the same style as Yosef and his brothers, but they take on many forms. This includes the split of the kingdom between Israel and Judah after the reign of King Solomon. It includes all of the fractionalization among the Jewish people and the various issues that they have with with each other. Now, I'm saying this as a sort of a preface. Instead of saying it after, I'll say it after also. What I'm talking about now is, if you look at today's Jewish society, you look at Ashkenazim and Sfardim and the tension and friction between them. Not as bad as it used to be, but it's still there. Is this the same as Yosef and his brothers in detail? No. But it's the same by virtue of the fact that Yosef and his brothers were part of the same family, and that Ashkenazim and Sfardim are part of the same family. And if we're talking about religious and non-religious, that's not the same as Ashkenazim and Sfardim. It's not the same as Yosef and his brothers. But on one way of looking at it, it is the same. And the same thing goes for Hasidish and non-Hasidish, and Haredi and Chardal and Dati Leumi and traditional and modern Orthodox. You just make up new labels, and you're describing not only differences, but clashes in whatever reason, for whatever reason, clashes between Jews are not healthy for the Jewish people. They prevent us from uniting in the way that we should be to be able to stand up totally and completely to our enemies from the outside. Now, that was part of the Hanukkah story also, which is why I'm bringing it up. You had, in addition to the Yevanim, the Greeks, the Hellenists, you had the Mityavnim, Jews who embraced the Hellenistic way of life and toned down or negated their Torah Judaism, and those that didn't, of course, and there was a clash, and that was serious also. Now, our sages were smart, and they did not highlight the internal strife that happened in the pre-Hanukkah story, but it was there. And we see it in a tiny way in the Al Hanisim, when we say about God thanking him, "You and your mercy," I'll read it in the English translation of the Koran Siddur, "It was then that you and your great compassion stood by them the time of their distress. You championed their cause, judged their claim, and avenged their wrong." Here, "You delivered the strong into the hands of the weak," That's the Greeks into the hands of the Jews. The many into the hands of the few. Same thing. The impure into the hands of the pure. The wicked into the hands of the righteous. And the arrogant into the hands of those who are engaged in the study of your Torah. There are people who analyze this part of the Hanukkah prayer and say that last piece, Zedim Biyad Oskei Toratecha, was, without identifying it as such, was a reference not to the Greeks into the hands of the Jews. You had your other metaphors for that. That's not the right word, but whatever. It was this, Zedim Biyad Oskei Toratecha, that was talking about the internal clash between the Jews who arrogantly shunned Torah and said, maybe the Greeks have a good idea, and maybe we should modernize, and who needs the old-fashioned stuff? And that has its echo to this very day. Side point, I've always felt it was a little odd that non-religious people observe Hanukkah, light candles, and sing the songs, because some of the victory of Hanukkah was against their ilk. Anyway, side point. Again, I say, to me it's unavoidable to lean Parshat Vayeshev with the enmity between Yosef and his brothers, and a couple of days later to start Hanukkah, without saying, well, wait a minute, happened then, still happening now. So that's something we have to analyze, we have to pay attention to, and I don't know if I'm going to continue exploring that in the second half of the show. I want to focus on some other issues of Hanukkah, and I usually say, hold that thought. This time I'll say, store that thought in a file in your brain, and we'll move on to other things. We'll be right back in a moment. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Vayeshev in the pre-Hanukkah show. And that little piece of happy birthday was not just to grandsons Elad and Roi, not even to daughter Orah, who gave birth twice on November 21st, and to the father Noam, but it was also connected to the Sedra in an obvious way, but I'll leave that to you to remember or to find out. What started the first show, the first half of the show, I don't think I'll tell you. If you know, let me know that you know by writing to me at tt@ou.org, tt@ou.org, and we'll take it from there. Okay, what I want to do now, I was going to sort of combine three thoughts on Hanukkah, but I realize that next week in Yiratz Hashem will be a Hanukkah show, and the week after I will be recording on the eighth day of Hanukkah, and whether you listen to it on Hanukkah or after Hanukkah, I won't know, but it'll still be okay to have a Hanukkah thought there. So I don't know what I'm going to leave and what I'm going to get to, but let me start with something that has caused me to think a lot over the many years that I've been observing Hanukkah. And that's the question of why an eight-day holiday. Now, in the past, I've spoken about a different angle to that question. There's a famous question that's known as the question of the Beit Yosef, although apparently it's older than Rav Yosef Karo, but he gets the credit for the question. And the question is, if a one-day supply of oil miraculously lasted 8 days, then that means 7 days of miracle. Why do we celebrate eight? There are books that have been written with hundreds of attempted answers to that question. And they're very enjoyable to look at because not only do people give answers to the question with a little twist here and there, but they also shoot down other people's answers in order to explain why their answer is the real answer. And it makes for sort of like fun reading on Hanukkah. But I don't want to get into that now. I want to look at something else. And I've mentioned this recently, but I'm putting it together day by day. Fact, Hanukkah is 8 days long. Ask a kindergarten kid or anyone else who started with kindergarten education about Hanukkah, and he will tell you, silly, don't you know the story of Hanukkah? There was Greek oppression and then a revolt against the Greeks, and the Jews were successful, and they came to clean up the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, and they found that it had been defiled, and they wanted to light the menorah, and they didn't have any oil, and then they looked and looked, and finally they found a one-day supply of oil. They said, okay, that's the best we could do. So they put it into the menorah, and lo and behold, a miracle occurred, and it lasted for 8 days. So our sages made an 8-day holiday of Hanukkah, and we mark it by the saying of Hallel and the lighting of Hanukkah lights each night of the 8 days. Okay, that was very satisfying all the years in the past, and in the last number of years, something about it bothered me. And I'm not talking about the question, why not 7, why 8? That has a lot of nice answers. I'm talking about, to me, something that's more fundamental, but it comes in the form of the following. In the Ma'oz Tzur song, we sing, B'nei Vina Yemei Shmona Kav'u Shir Urinanim. B'nei Vina, men of deep understanding, Bina, goes way beyond knowledge and wisdom. Much deeper than that. Men of deep understanding, Yemei Shmona, 8 days they fixed this holiday for singing God's praise. I don't think that it requires men of deep understanding to say, oil lasted for 8 days, let's have an 8-day holiday. I think that's a no-brainer. Furthermore, I don't know why we would think that there has to be an element in the story about which the holiday comes that then manifests itself in how many days long the holiday is. Holidays don't work like that. Pesach is 7 days, 8 days outside of Israel, but it's a 7-day holiday from the Torah, not because of anything that particularly happened for 7 days. It is a celebration of the redemption from Egypt. And Sukkot and Simchat Torah and Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, there is no Behechrech, there's no compulsion to choose a length of the holiday to match a number of days that something happened in the story. We don't find, for example, that Purim was 3 days because Esther asked Mordechai to gather the Jews of Shushan and fast on her behalf for 3 days. That's part of the story, and it does not reflect itself in how long the holiday is. That's not how holidays are made. And even if you want to say they are, it still doesn't compel us to attribute great and deep understanding to the wise sages who picked that number. I think there is something much more significant on that level of Bina, deep understanding. And I believe that the miracle that lasted for 8 days was God's way of pointing us in the direction of 8, not just to say 8, therefore, 8 days, therefore, 8 day holiday, but to see the specialness in that number 8, and to then realize that the miracle matched it, rather than the miracle is responsible for our picking 8. I don't know if I'm getting across yet. I hope I am. I'm making a little sense. But now let me take one of 3 possible manifestations of 8 that I believe are very significant contributory factors in our sages fixing an 8-day holiday, and the miracle of the oil just is God's way of smiling and sealing of a seal of approval to our decision to make that an 8-day holiday. I would like to suggest the following. Out of all the things that went into the Greek strategy to break down the Jew and his separateness, there was an attempt on the Greeks' part to assimilate us, which can't possibly happen if we remain faithful to the Torah. So if you are in a position to ban Torah learning from the Jewish people, the keeping of Shabbat from the Jewish people, the setting up of the calendar from the Jewish people, the performance of mitzvot such as circumcision, keep that from the Jewish people, then what you hope to accomplish as an enemy is a stripping away of Torah and mitzvot from the Jewish people, where they will then say, hey, we're like everybody else, and the thing in our time is Greek philosophy, Hellenism, let's go for it. That was the strategy. We celebrate Hanukkah for the miracles and the victories over that attempt to destroy our Judaism and to tear us away from it, and that's enough. But there was one element in the Greek approach to the Jewish people, which was more than a strategy to tear us away from Torah. I believe, for example, that they can't really argue against Shabbat, a day of rest commemorating creation. All right, they could pick and choose different elements of that to make excuses to fight against. But essentially, the idea that people should acknowledge appreciation to the divine force who has created the world and looks out for people. This is in many, many different cultures. They wanted us to stop observing certain things because they had their goal of assimilating us, but not because there was anything intrinsic to the particular observance that they were opposed to, with a singular exception of Brit Milah, circumcision. When it comes to circumcision, the Greeks and other cultures as well said, oh, wait a minute. You mean to say that you are going to mutilate the body of an 8-day-old baby when his physical form is perfect, where Greek philosophy and culture venerated art and sculpture and sport, all focusing on the perfection of the human body, and the Jewish people are desecrating that body by this vulgar act of circumcision. It gave the Greeks a handle to hold on to say, we're not just trying to assimilate you and make you like everyone else in our empire. We oppose in principle, in policy, in theology, and everything else, the circumcision that you do and you think so much of. So, when we were, by the grace of God, successful in our military endeavors and in purifying the Beit HaMikdash and in having God's smile of approval, so to speak, with the miracle of the oil and everything else. Chazal said, okay, there's that one point which we need to perpetuate in the commemoration of Chanukah for all generations, as if we hold a banner high with the number 8. 8 is that number which the Maharal describes as going beyond nature. The 7 Noahide laws are the natural laws that all people should follow. The command of Brit Milah is the 8th mitzvah in the world. After the 7, that was the one given to Avraham Avinu. It's for the 8th day, and the 8th day represents going beyond nature. Nature created the body of a male with a foreskin. We go beyond that at God's command by the removal of the foreskin and the pulling back of the skin, etc., etc., and performing circumcision as a sign that, no, we are not created perfect. We are created unfinished, and that God commands us to finish that physical form. But that's not the whole story. It's to finish the spiritual form as well. It is a challenge throughout a lifetime of all the Jewish people, for themselves and for their children, to constantly improve and develop their spiritual being. And that is symbolized by the covenant of circumcision. So Chazal said, you know what? We're not just going to make a one-day holiday celebrating the victories and the miracles. And we're not going to make a 12-day holiday to match the 12 days of the gifts of the leaders of the tribes in order to consecrate the altar in the time of the first temple, which was the Mikdash, the temporary one in the wilderness, which would have been an interesting candidate to have 12 days, and if we had 12 days, we would not have any question about it. We would have bigger boxes of candles, and we would use up more oil, and whatever, raise the temperature in the house that lights a lot of candles. But it wouldn't be surprising, in fact, if you look at the Torah reading for Chanukah, on the first day of Chanukah, we read the portion from the Torah in Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 7, which speaks about the gift of the of the leader, the Nasi, on the first day of dedication of the Mizbeach. Chanukah, that term, was used way back then, and we read the Torah portion that corresponds with day 1 for the first Nasi, and day 2, and day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, day 7. When we get to day 8, we're out of days of Chanukah. But we have the 8th Nasi, and the 9th, and the 10th, and the 11th, and the 12th, and the summary, and finally, the lighting of the menorah in the Beit, in the Mishkan. So it's sort of like a guy with a long pair of pants that has no choice but to roll up his cuffs, because Chazal said, we are fixing this holiday at 8 days, specifically 8 days, to say not only were the Greeks wrong for trying to tear us away from Torah and trying to assimilate us into the Hellenistic culture, they were wrong on this policy of opposing Brit Milah when it is such an important part, sign of the covenant that we have with God. And therefore they built it in. And then in later generation, they even sharpened the focus on 8, because originally the rule was you lit an oil lamp for 8 days, one on the first night, and one on the second night, and one on the third night, etc. Later generations said, you know what? We think it should be 1 the first night, 2 the second night, 3 the third night, etc. Different opinion starts with 8, goes down to 7. The result is the same. You are now counting, and when you count, you're focusing on a number. And that number that you're focusing on is 8. When you have a Chanukiah, and you, the first night of Hanukkah, you put one candle in one of the cup holders, and you light it, you look at the Chanukiah, and there are 7 more places which will get their use in the next 7 days, but it's 8. It's not just one and another and another and another and another and another, and am I finished yet? Another. It's more than that. It's one first day of 8, two candles of 8, 3 candles of 8, until finally a full Chanukiah with 8 candles of 8. That was, I believe, the efforts of B'nai Vina, men of deep understanding, who fixed this holiday specifically at 8. That was one of the stanzas from Ma'oz Tzur, the one that deals with the Hanukkah story, and that's where the phrase that I've been using, B'nai Vina Yimei Shmona, comes from. Now, there's another angle, which I'm not going to have time to explore, and maybe next week, and that is the connection between Hanukkah and Sukkot. There are amazing links between the two, and it seems, again, that our B'nai Vina, our men of deep understanding, our sages who fixed the day, the holiday of Chanukah, wanted an obvious match with Sukkot. The 8-day holiday where we say Hallel on each day, full Hallel, just like Chanukah and just like Sukkot, and several other connections, which I'm not going to mention now, but they really, really make an interesting case for it. I will add one other element of 8. And again, it all dances away from or around the 8-day miracle. And I don't mean to marginalize that. I don't mean to minimize it. I mean to give it a little different angle, a little different perspective. There's the episode, the story in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, which describes something that happened much longer ago than the Hanukkah story. In fact, it goes back to close to creation. And that is that Adam Harishon, Adam, the Gemara says, noticed that the days were getting shorter and shorter, the sunlight was staying out shorter and shorter periods, and nighttime was lengthening. And he did not have the experience of years to realize that this was a cycle of nature. He thought the world was coming to an end, returning to the darkness and chaos that preceded creation, and he blamed himself for it, because he ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and that he was the cause of the destruction. And the Gemara says that he fasted for 8 days and prayed to God, and then realized that the day began lengthening, and when he realized that this was nature and not something that he had caused, he celebrated with an 8-day holiday, midwinter. His celebration was L'shem Shamayim, for the sake of heaven, and later generations perverted it into a pagan kind of thing. It could be that Hanukkah restored the L'shem Shamayim, for the sake of heaven, aspect of an 8-day holiday midwinter. That's all I have time for now. Have a Shabbat Shalom, and we will talk more, Amir Tz Hashem, next week. L'hishtameah.